to give the Maragorku credit. The great goblins made a great show of climbing the slope in perfect order, until they reached the pockets of supersaturated soil just below the dry line. They had been making good pace before then, stomping through the perfectly ordinary mud without too much problem, until they hit the spell field. Then the front ranks bogged down, thanks to their heavy iron armor, and the ranks behind stalled and pressed up against them unhelpfully. Yet still they continued. With a guttural war cry and a seductively menacing chant in their own language, they pressed forward to the beat of their drums, pushing their great wooden shields ahead of them as they steadfastly put one mud-bound foot in front of the other. Their officers screamed at them to move faster, some using long, wicked-looking whips to encourage the laggards. It was not without effect, I saw. The line slowly moved up the slope. A few in the first rank fell to pits, hidden there by Marsden's folk, or lumbered into pockets of especially viscous mud that held them fast, or encountered fiendishly irritating magical constructs who would bar their way. But most pushed on with determination, every foot forward a step toward victory. As they got a fifth of the way uphill, a command rang out, and many of the shields dropped. In a moment, the entire first three ranks pulled out the new style of crossbow Corbal's Dradrian had developed, and cries of "Incoming!" rang out. A moment later, a hail of iron bolts rained down, 20 feet from our foremost line. Marsden wasted no time in a response. 3,000 archers drew and loosed from the hilltop at once. A storm of yard-long arrows flew downhill through the pouring rain and savaged the front ranks of the Gavanni. While most of them failed to reach a mark, enough did to turn their once orderly line into a wandering and uneven shadow of itself. Still, they persisted. Driven by duty or anger or their foul master's spells, the Maragorku rallied and continued struggling through the mud. A second volley from our archers took another tithe from the determined foe, but they continued on. They reached the first real spell field, where glyphs and enchantments turned some into berserkers who slew their own comrades, or simpering cowards who tried to flee, but they pressed through. When they reached the halfway point up the How, their bodies caked with thick brown mud, oft stained with patches of blood, they encountered the first of the larger arcane constructs. Many fell to the magical drones. Still, they persisted. Only half of the Maragorku who began the struggle to climb that hill survived to the hydrophobic point. It was humorous to watch the mighty effort they produced turn against them as they lost their balance when they suddenly encountered firm footing. Another volley of shafts made their stumbles fatal as the archers in the front ranks were able to take aimed shots. Then they encountered the third wave of constructs, and that essentially halted their line. Infantry cannot exist long under sustained fire, and the constructs were making it impossible to advance while the Maragorku were taking fire from the archers. At some point, a goblin with some sense decided that retreat was in order, and for his sake, I hope he died on the way down. The Enshadowed are not known for their mercy for those they see as cowards. But under tremendous pressure, the line broke and retreated and withdrew as orderly as they could when it was clear their numbers were not sufficient to challenge us at the top. That was perfectly fine for us. It was raining, and we were under a canopy. As the tide of angry Maragorku infantry receded, I could see the small collection of officers surrounding the herald push him forward to the front of the line. In front of them were thousands of arrows decorating the muddy terrain in the bodies of hundreds of corpses. A few of the constructs from the upper slopes, having defeated the mud-bound attackers, were making their way down the grade, nimbly passing over the mire on multiple legs. "It appears we merit a talking to," Astaroth smirked. "You wish to do the honours, Menelan? You are the ranking sovereign," he pointed out. "Mistress Marsden has commanded the battle admirably," I demurred. "The honour of treating with the foes should rightly fall to her." A confirming nod from Timoniel justified my decision. "Not that it really matters, but that is the protocol, in context of the ancient Alka-Alon mode of warfare," he affirmed. "Personally, I prefer the Humani variety. Far more efficient. My people are far too invested in such ceremonial productions. It gets in the way of action affecting real change."
"You should attend a Gilmoran tournament," Astaroth suggested. "I think you would find it instructive."
"You may get your chance before you know it," I commented cryptically. "In any case,
They have raised the flag of truce. Staff of truce? There's a white pole in the hands of one of them, I observed. I would like one of you to attend Mistress Marsden as a matter of honour. Asteron, you have managed this mission with smooth accomplishment. Would you accompany the Keeper to her embassy? I would like nothing better, he assured, standing and straightening his mantle. Astaroth affects a casual attitude, but he knew what this meant. He was acting as my deputy, representing my interests, and reporting the proceedings directly. It was an important post, and he wanted to do well in the sight of his friend. Though not his liege, Astaroth understood the politics of the situation perhaps better than anyone. I watched him accompany Marsden and a half dozen of her commanders down the slope, carefully avoiding the dead and dying Gavanni, until they met with Shakathet's emissary almost all the way down. It was a harrowing few minutes, as they exchanged formalized insults under the flag of truce. Then both parties left the truce zone and continued back toward the lines. It was pretty standard, Astaroth reported mind to mind as he trudged back up the muddy slope. They came up and demanded our unconditional surrender because Shakathet is such a powerful badass. We responded by invoking the spellmonger, our own mighty badass, who promised to rain down death and destruction on them. They countered with the knowledge of ancient lore and mystic secrets. The crap you say when you might have something that will be helpful, but it might not. All in all, their presentation was lame. Their threats were anemic, and their sense of style was completely pedestrian. Really, Min, could you not find a better class of enemy? Next time I'll pick a fight with the Tailors of Rhemir, I quipped. Who was in command, according to the Herald? I asked, curious. Shakathet himself, admitted Astaroth. Apparently the old boy is adamant about defeating you personally, and wants to distinguish himself on the field. His head is so far up Korbel's arse that if the demon god farts, Shakathet will know what he had for breakfast, he quipped. He doesn't strike me as an obsequious toady, I pointed out. Oh, he's not. He's a loyal, devoted servant to the Dark Lord, completely committed to prosecuting his rightful claim, blah, blah, blah. He sounds like one of Tavard's adherents, he observed. If Tavard was immortal, powerful, or competent. At the risk of an attack of ego, did he mention my name? I asked, curious. Oh, his enmity for the spellmonger was one of his prime motivations, Astaroth reported. He has taken great offense that you invaded his demonic majesty's personal fortress and magically condemned him to a putrescent demise. He demands you reverse your foul spell, blah, blah, blah. He demands you withdraw from protecting the weak-kneed kindreds of the Alka Alon, who are hiding behind the brute Humani, blah, blah, blah. And he demands you retire and devote your life to the restoration of the pristine nature of the Western lands, blah, blah, blah. In short, Astaroth continued, he didn't say anything of significance, though he did hint of some dire consequence if we ignored his prudent warnings and don't surrender at his command. If I didn't already know about the secret weapon, I might have been concerned, but its approach gave the poor bastard even greater confidence, which led to even greater pomposity. Dear gods, this herald needs to have an ale or two with Caswallon, Astaroth proposed. They have a similar sense of style. It never pays to be too smug about a secret weapon. The gods have a sense of irony. But Shakathet is, indeed, overseeing this battle? I asked, intrigued. From what the Herald says, yes, Astaroth confirmed. He's in a command tent somewhere a mile or more from here. He's sending in trolls next, by the way, he added. He said as much. Just to soften us up for the secret weapon. He made a lot of jests about how sleep-deprived we'd be after a night of repelling his Maragorku, and about how many bodies he'd leave in the wake of the assault. So bugger him with a battering ram sideways, Astaroth declared. You can guess just how eloquent Mistress Marsden was about his threats. She'd heard better from angry townswomen. She was not impressed, he related admiringly. Neither am I assured him. This parley is likely to be followed by another attack. Get back behind the lines quickly. It's going to be a long night. And it was. Before the heralds withdrew from parley, the arrow started flying between the forces. We did take some hits from that, thanks to the superior range of the Maragorku crossbows, but the mud and our magical constructs kept too many of them from advancing that night, and those who did make it up the slope faced irate, well-armed Vanadori peasants who took issue with the intrusion. There was much killing in the trenches that night, and even more on the slopes. My team and I really didn't do much, save monitor the situation and add a bit of arcane assistance when called for. As battles went, it was long, tedious, and bloody. Three elements no good warrior wishes on himself. Yet our folk did admirably at keeping the Gavanni legions from assaulting the hill. The bowmen kept their spare bowstrings dry in their helmets between engagements, and our heavy infantry met our mudbound foes at the line of hydrophobia and sliced them to slivers when they crossed it. All throughout the night, our people kept the foe at bay with magic, steel, and pure fury. My team made one significant contribution when the enemy got too close to our lines. Three or four times, Caswallon, Tamoniel, Buroso, and Landrick crossed the lines and assaulted the foe directly. Caswallon, of course, made several heroic counterattacks. Despite his vainglory, I credit the man with sustaining the center of the line when it looked like it would break. I just wish to the gods that I didn't have to hear him retell the story with graphic, glorious embellishment. A man can only take so many adjectives in his life. As promised, a third wave of 30 trolls tried their luck on the slope, followed by more Maragorku warriors. Despite their longer legs and greater strength, the trolls fared little better than the great goblins. More than half made it up to the line, but they were covered in sticky mud when their feet finally gained purchase on relatively dry ground, and that slowed their movements dramatically. But they were effective, alas. They tore apart our battlefield constructs by ripping the legs off of them or hurling them down the hill. That's when Marsden released her own special defense against the brutes. The mistress of the field had a great antipathy toward trolls, and she and Carmella had anticipated such an attack. To respond, they built a great hollow wooden wheel, 8 feet in diameter, which was rolled to the center of the line. Two thick chains were attached to the hub, as the hollow space was filled with rocks. The chains were stretched out across the lines, anchored at both ends with a literal anchor, and then they pushed the wheel down the hill. It was a smaller version of Turlaman's millstone, only instead of crushing the enemy directly, the long length of chain twisted and snapped like a whip as the wheel gained momentum. By the time it crashed into the line of trolls and goblins, it had gained enough speed, even dragging the chains, that it dashed the first troll it hit off of his feet and over it. When he landed, he didn't move. The heavy chains, on the other hand, whipped around wildly, snapping bones and bashing skulls when it wasn't sweeping the foe off of their feet. As non-magical defenses went, Marsden's wheel was reasonably effective. It was certainly entertaining. Our men cheered in the downpour as they watched the trolls struggle to avoid it and then struggled to recover from it. As applause, they added another few volleys of arrows to complicate their lives further. The last few surviving trolls who made it up the hill ended up facing our heavy infantry, who swarmed them, hacking at them with pole axes and pikes. As dawn broke, behind the clouds, the brightening sky revealed a tortured hillside covered in arrows, bodies, and broken constructs. The rain slackened for a few moments, enough time for some of our men to go retrieve our own dead and wounded and clean some of the arrows they'd spent. "Probably time for a magical attack," Landrick observed from our canopy. "They've done brute force, they've brought in the heavy infantry, and now it's time for magic. It's like reading the same book over and over again. I thought Shakathet was a military genius," he complained. "Their magical core hasn't gotten set up yet, I'm guessing," Astoral proposed as he surveyed the devastation. "They're still getting reinforcements, but they'll have 3 hells worth of trouble trying to lay a hook anywhere on this hill," he smirked. "The enshadowed spheres are quite adept at thaumaturgical denial spells. I'm just glad they haven't been able to get their artillery set up, such as it is," Buroso said. One of the happy results of the constant rain had been the loss of most of Shakathet's mobile artillery. The great wheeled catapults and mangonels were quick to bog down in the thick wilderland's mud. In our armies, using magic to keep such things from happening is standard. The Enshadowed, apparently, considered that work for goblins and trolls. Their sorcerers were far too important to waste their magic on such mundane things. As a result, there was a long line of stranded artillery that stretched back for miles. Every swollen streamlet was an obstacle that required enormous effort to cross.
"I wouldn't be so sanguine about that," Timoneos said quietly. "I think they have another plan. Do you feel it? Do you hear it?" he asked.
We looked at him quizzically. Apparently, Terra Alana are more sensitive to vibration than humans are, else Timoneos was just very aware. We all scanned the cloudy horizon, searching for what he was referring to, both with bare eyes and mage sight, but I didn't detect any increases in the arcane signatures around the hill. But then I saw what Timoneos was hearing. Behind the lines of the foe waiting to die on our hill, beyond the few wains and carts they'd managed to bring that far, there was a commotion. A dark figure loomed in the obscuring rain, casting a shadow over the Givani horde in the pale morning gloom. Every few moments there was a subtle vibration that rattled the very ground. I could see the small puddles around the canopy begin to ripple in unison.
"Oh, Ishi's weeping twat," swore Barroso. "What in nine hells is that thing?" he asked, his mouth agape as the figure came into sight. "That can't be that big. The scale is off. Or is it?" he asked, confused.
"Your eyes are not deceiving you, my friend," sighed Timoneos. "The Enshadowed have once again indulged in a cruel and abhorrent practice, even in war. They've done so before, back during the ancient wars. Oft they turned whatever power they had into a weapon. Their evil can twist anything in nature, I fear.
Menelan, is that a troll?" Caswallon asked uneasily.
"No," I said softly, as the beast became clearer through the rain. "That's Shakathet's secret weapon. That, my friends, is a giant."
Chapter 27. Lord Tiny. The land is wide, wild, and filled with legends. Wilderland's folk saying. From the collections of Janik the Rish. Giants are legend. Once the Chandler-turned-spy had told Janik and me about Shakathet's secret weapon at that tavern, we'd both been highly skeptical. Giants, Janik assured me, did not exist. They were fables, constructs of the human imagination designed to frighten children and bring wonder to adults. Nonetheless, I had to take the information seriously. I knew that there had been, at least at some time in the past, a race of giants, but I'd been told that they were extinct. I had confirmed it with Heath, my arcanist, who knows about such obscurities, and he assured me that there was not one reliable account in history or lore about giants. But there were plenty of legends. Heath put together a summary of the consensus opinion on what the giants were, culled from those legends. It was a short scroll. Giants were alleged to be anywhere from 12 feet tall, the size of an adult troll, to 50 or 60, though there was folklore that told of 1 or 2 hundred-foot giants, tales Heath discounted. They were omnivorous, though allegedly preferred the flesh of naughty young human children. More folklore. They were famously ugly. They ranged from stupidly moronic to merely slow-witted. They were brutally strong and incredibly tough. They used clubs the size of tree trunks, and they were violent. While it was marginally useful as a summary, Heath's scroll did not answer the question of whether or not giants existed. For that, I went to Lelastian, who knows a hell of a lot more about things than Heath does. She'd been on this world for more than 1,000 years, and she studied such things professionally.
"Yes, there are giants," she had assured me a few weeks before in Spellgarden, when I summoned her to discuss the matter. "The Deliuli, they are called. Poor things, they are technically Alon. That is, we brought them with us from our homeworld. But they are of a different genotype, distantly related to the Karshek and Dradrian. Very distantly. Our ancestors only brought a few, but they were useful, especially in the early days. Then they became a nuisance. They have just above an animal intelligence, and some were taught to speak, but they live in a much different scale than we do. They barely take notice of us if we do not exert some power to attract their attention. Even when we do, it is difficult to communicate with them. They never did thrive on this part of Kalador, she said sadly.
Why not? I asked, intensely curious.
Well, the climate wasn't to their liking, as they mostly prefer cool areas, she explained, but it was mostly a matter of diet. Bodies that size require a tremendous amount of protein to survive, much less breed. When the Alon settled this region, there were few animals here large enough for any reasonable-sized population to sustain itself. They don't breed very quickly. Their females carry to term in 2 years, she said, horrified. While you would think that they wouldn't be prone to natural predators, Kalador does have some who hunt them. Your own people did some damage to the population in the first 30 years of settlement. They interfered with the terraforming program and were relocated. In their natural state, they tend to be solitary and highly territorial.
But then why do they serve? I asked. I can't imagine that something that big is going to be intimidated by anything our size.
In the old days, they were enticed with food and given some direction, when we needed them to work, she reported. We tried to keep their ranging territories safe for them, too. Like the Hulka Alon, their young will fight with each other over territory and mating rights. But when the Enshadowed first tried to overthrow the Council here, they turned to a lot of unconventional weapons to fight their wars. Beyond Maragorku, dragons and other surrogates for their own power, they managed to force their will over a few giants. They got them enraged and then used them to destroy. Castabriel was assaulted by giants once, she said, referring to the ancient Alka Alon city that the current capital of Castol was built on. The Council condemned it, of course. It was cruel to use the Deliuli so damnably. But then the Enshadow did so many vile things like that that it often gets overlooked. So Corbel had somehow procured a giant, and it was now stomping toward Stannis Howe through the rain. The legends say giants are ugly, but the legends dramatically understate that. While vaguely humanoid, the proportions of the beastly thing were far different than most things with 2 hands and 2 feet. Its shoulders seemed far wider than was necessary, so it seemed almost as wide as it was tall. Its arms were short and stubby, comparatively speaking, though its hands were long and wide, like shovels. But that head, that hideous head, there was no neck, exactly, and I doubt any neck could hold up the proportionally outsized skull, which seemed to have 2 lobes. The ears were small, and the face, gods, the face looked like an old car shack who had been thrown in a barrel and tossed down a hill, submerged in a muddy pond, then beaten with a stick and allowed to fester in the sun. It had a beard of sorts, or perhaps calling it a mane is more accurate. But as I examined it more closely with mage sight, I saw the huge, roomy eyes, and I knew we were in for some trouble. They were a dark colour between brown and red, and they stared in a daze towards Stannis Howe. There was deep sadness and pain in those eyes, but there was also anger and resentment behind the dazed expression. Then the giant opened its horrible mouth and roared, revealing jagged, broken teeth nearly 4 feet long. The cry was inhuman, yet belligerent. Much of my sympathy for the giant evaporated as the sound of the yell faded. That thing was a terrifying beast who wanted to destroy us. Dear gods, Astaroth said, shaking his head in disbelief as the giant was led forward through the Gavanni lines by a cadre of handlers. I'd really hoped we were wrong. Would you prefer a dragon? Landric asked sarcastically. I'll let you know after the battle. Astaral murmured. Min, you did say you have a plan for this? He asked, concerned. Lord Tiny is 50 feet tall at least, and doesn't look like it's going to go down from arrows, or mangonels for that matter, he added. You do have a plan for this, don't you?
Of course I do, I assured. I closed my eyes for a moment and gave the order to activate it. When I opened them, everyone was looking at me skeptically.
I do, I promise, I said, when I realized they weren't terribly certain that I did. But I did have a plan. Indeed, after long consultation with Lelastian about the potential, however unlikely, that a giant might enter the battle, we'd come up with several possible ways to deal with it. My first choice involved pissing it off even more.
Lelastian says that these things rarely even take note of us lesser beings, I explained as we waited. That is, they just don't usually notice us, and they don't pay attention well. When the Alka-Alon used them in war...
The Enshadowed used them in war,
Timoniel corrected. Important distinction, I conceded. When the Enshadowed used them, they had to use magic to compel their attention, and then they had to hold it long enough to get them moving in the right direction. Then they would go stomp through the enemy, barely noticing the bloody muck on their feet, and tear down a few walls.
It appears that he's under a sorcerous enthrallment,
Timoniel said distastefully. When the consensus effect that exists even in the Deliuli is used to dominate a weaker mind by a stronger one, the stronger mind can enthrall the weaker. Once enthralled, they are easier to control. It's a perversion of our magic, he explained, but it gives them tremendous control over the giant.
Can it be broken?
Barroso asked, hopefully. If it becomes too distracted by pain or other fascination, conceded the Terra Alon War Mage, but that is difficult. As I said, it's hard to get a giant's attention. The Gavani and the Maragorku legions who had formed ranks to make another attempt at the slope parted and allowed the giant and his handlers through. I was surprised by how wide a berth the goblins gave it, but then I saw its feet and understood. They were like two great misshapen anvils, gnarled and heavy, as they would need to be to hold that thing up. When they came too near one of the troop formations, occasionally it would brush them, sending three or four Gavani flying every time he took a step. I could tell they could smash an armored knight to pulp just as easily as they did the goblins. Indeed, the giant became so enraged by the spell, or the suffering of his captivity, that he lashed out with one great foot and trampled about a squadron of goblins that apparently annoyed him.
"Yes, do that some more,"
Landric encouraged him from afar.
It matters not how large the foe is, Caswallon began, as he pulled his mage blade free of its scabbard. Men of true valor fear not the size of the challenge, and this fellow is about to...
Relax, Caswallon, I urged. If things go properly, you will not have to test yourself against this foe. The fox looked disappointed and returned his sword to its scabbard with a sigh.
You are a wizard of subtle cunning, my lord. I look forward to seeing what you have prepared.
He didn't sound too enthusiastic about it. I think the idiot actually wanted to fight the giant. Step by languorous step, the giant moved through the lines, until it faced the churned-up, super-saturated muddy field where bodies were scattered like cabbages. The giant stopped and looked around, confused, as if he did not understand how to proceed. Whoever was controlling the spell that enthralled it eventually got the idea across, and the giant gave another toothy roar. A cheer came from the Gavani ranks, loud enough we could hear it over the rain. Everyone likes to know that the biggest warrior is on your side. Of course, every roar diminished our own side's morale pretty harshly. Suddenly, Stannis Howe did not seem nearly tall enough. That's when Mistress Marsden opened fire with the artillery she'd established at the Crown. Stones were flung at the giant with great force, as the catapults, mangonels, and small trebuchets the Hessian Order had brought to the artillery battery spat projectiles at an impressive pace. Rocks the size of wheelbarrows launched into the rainy sky with magically augmented force, but they did little damage when they hit the giant, save for pissing it off. The rocks apparently hurt, even if they did not injure. I'm not certain the thing even understood it was being attacked. It merely howled with animalistic pain, filling the countryside with its bitter cry.
Why, it's like a big baby,
Landric observed.
That toddler could take down a castle tower in a blink of an eye, Astaroth predicted, as more rocks were hurled at it.
Min, don't you think we'd better start attacking it?
Wait for it, I ordered. Don't cast anything yet. I don't want to worry about what it might do to our people. If I plan things right...
Min, if that thing takes two more steps, he'll be a third of the way up the mountain, warned Landric.
Then it will face the wrath of Caswallon the Fox,
Caswallon declared.
And crush a few score of our men, Barroso predicted. One of those hands could scrape every pavilion off of this hill in the blink of an eye.
Thankfully, the giant continued to balk at being told to wade into the mud. The bottom of the hill was one grand bloody mire now, and the giant just didn't see the point. Even the rocks we were throwing were starting to get to him. He tried to wave them away like flies. I was seriously starting to get worried about my plan when I heard a welcome noise in the distance. I finally smiled. When the Lastian told me about the Deliuli, I explained, we went over their weaknesses. One pretty obvious one is that they don't pay attention to the little things. Pretty much anything from their ankles down is ignored, even if it is destroyed. You can shoot arrows into a giant's foot all day, and they might not even notice. They'd be just as likely to stomp on you and not even realize it. I'm still not feeling that sense of confidence I am starting to desire, Min, Astaroth chided. The giant took a tentative step into the thick mud. He didn't look happy about it. In fact, he balked and took a step back when his feet sunk into the mud. Then he bellowed again. The noise did not improve by being closer. Bide, I warned. Just wait for it, I promised. After a few false steps, the giant was finally convinced to move forward up the slope. After the first few tentative steps, the giant got more confident, and faster. Every step brought him quickly toward us, albeit without much grace. The mud that clung to his great feet only seemed to make him madder. Dara, now would be a good time to act, I called to my vassal, mind to mind. We're on the way, she insisted. About 4 miles to the north of the hill. The birds don't like to fly in the rain, she chided. They're moving slowly, and this western wind is giving us trouble. Just keep him busy until we get there. Whatever they were doing to the creature was working, as it continued to roar to the excited chanting of thousands of Gavani. Then it turned back toward the hill and began to slowly push his way up the mired slope. His feet smashed into the soft ground until he had to use his hands to pull himself up, but he continued to come. "Shouldn't we be doing something, my lord?" Barroso asked worriedly as we watched the giant get closer. The archers cut loose with a volley, but the arrows did little but annoy the creature. Another salvo of rocks from the engines enraged it further and made him stumble, but he recovered quickly. "Soon," he added anxiously as the giant got closer. "Nearly," I said through clenched teeth as we watched him approach the hydrophobic line. As soon as he got to there, I knew he would gain his footing and be within our ranks in 3 or 4 strides of his long legs. Mage lights near his face, as bright as you can make them, I said quickly, as I tried to think of a way to delay him just a bit. Now, I commanded, and cast my own. A sparkle of flashes burst in front of the giant's face, which startled him and caused him to stumble again. I didn't know what his range of vision was, but it was as if thousands of candles had flashed in his face, and that had to have an effect on his sight. He howled as he fell back into the mud, but he pushed himself back to his feet all too quickly. His eyes blinked wildly as he did so, and his thick head turned as he tried to orient himself again. "That much light did nothing to improve his features," Landry quipped. "Minelan, where is the secret weapon you have to use against their secret weapon?" As if to answer, the scree of a giant hawk cut through the sound of the rain. Another followed, and then another. Dark shadows appeared among the clouds as the birds broke through the canopy in a dive. 1, 2, then 4, then more than a score of birds, their riders poised for battle, came streaking down toward the giant. We all watched breathlessly on both sides as 2 full wings began to strike at the giant's broad head with their talons. While the arrows and stones it had endured before may have hurt, the Iltadine steel spurs attached to the giant falcon's powerful talons proved strong enough to score his thick skin and tear shards out of his flesh. The wounds weren't mortal. They weren't even particularly serious. But they bled profusely and, more importantly, they hurt. Rage and pain filled the creature as he stopped and screamed deafeningly just 100 yards from our line. The wings set up a pattern of circling the giant, weaving a net of feathers and steel, as each skyrider made it a point to attack the giant's eyes and face. If the pain from his scalp was bad, the sudden fear that bloomed in the big weepy eyes when they were scratched and attacked by skybolts was terrifying. When Nalastian and I discussed it, we noted that nothing we were going to be able to do to a giant from the knee down was likely to be decisive. They would be used to kicking something and shrugging it off. He knows that there's not much down here to be a threat. But when you take the fight to his face, I continued, as I watched Dara wheel frightful around, one drawn, and savage the left cheek of the creature. That's something he's going to be unused to. In a world divided into up here and down there, you just wouldn't be used to something in your face, especially something feathery and sharp. That would snap the bowstring of some people I know, agreed Landrick.
Yes, my cousin Reldine is like that, Astral agreed with a chuckle. She got a night web caught in her hair once when she was a girl, screeched horribly. Now she won't leave her chamber without wearing a wimple. She's scared of chickens, too, he smirked.
I'm guessing this giant has never really had to protect his face, I theorized. With the bright flash to obscure and confuse his vision, and then the sudden attack of the falcons, he's going to do something rash.
Hopefully not charge blindly into our line in a rage, Barroso said doubtfully as he watched the giant begin to panic at the unexpected attack, because that seems a possibility.
Note that they're attacking him primarily from the direction of the hill, I pointed out, as Natia's big bird screeched and slashed the giant across the bridge of its nose with its vicious talons, carving furrows a yard wide to open. The giant began to flail his massive arms in an attempt to swipe the birds away from his face. While they are avoiding the downhill side.
They'll never kill him like that, Timoniel said, shaking his head, not unless you have some other spell at work.
The goal isn't to kill him, I explained. A dead giant would be a handsome prize, should we win the day. A live giant, sufficiently panicked, may well be what does win the day.
Waving his arms like a windmill, the giant danced wildly, seeking to avoid or deflect the avian menace. The Skyriders redoubled their efforts, flying in his face over and over again, as fast as they could. As he began to stumble, I could see that my plan worked. First, he fell to one knee and tried to shield his face with his hand. But then he slipped on the insecure footing where magic had changed the nature of the hill's hydrology, and he fell on one shoulder and rolled downhill. The Gavanni legions, who had been chanting, turned to shouting and screaming, as they realized their supposed ally was now falling down the hill, a one giant avalanche of mud and pure, blind panic. He nearly recovered, halfway down the howe, and managed to get himself up on one knee. But when he tried to get his feet under him, one of them became entangled in the wheel and chain device Marsden had used against the trolls. It had rolled to a stop near the bottom of the hill and had been ignored the rest of the battle.
That's it, Dara! Now drive him off!
I ordered her, mind to mind. She didn't reply, but a quick change in formation and tactics demonstrated that she'd heard me. Dara's wing and Natia's wing took turns strafing the face of the giant, first on one side and then the other. As the confused creature thrashed around to avoid them, the chain around his ankle jerked the rock-filled wooden wheel into the front ranks of the Gavanni to devastating effect. We watched in awe as things went comically awry for our foes. The rage that the giant felt was fading, and absolute panic was now directing his actions. The tug on his ankle and the feathers in his face inspired him to take off running back through the Gavanni army, slinging the wheel and chains like a deadly flail that flattened everything it touched. The giant's feet likewise devastated Shakathet's soldiery. Piles of squashed bodies appeared like massive footprints as the panicked creature fled the field. Eventually, as the goblins fled his path in their own mindless panic, the giant tripped and fell on top of a great number of them. The once orderly lines were scattered into chaos.
I don't envy the enshadowed officers who have to clean up that mess, Astaroth said, shaking his head in wonder at what we had witnessed. What is the plan now? Attack and take advantage of their disarray?
We await word from Turlaman, I explained. Once he knows that the giant is out of the battle, he'll order us to retreat. Not a tank. Oh, the archers will continue to hammer at them, and the birds may have a go, but we're not to engage. The infantry will almost immediately start withdrawing to the east, toward the river. We'll follow, after we conduct a special mission.
What mission is that? Astaroth asked doubtfully.
Why, if Shakathet is out there commanding this mess, then he must be surrounded by plenty of enshadowed sorcerers with those pretty Irianite spheres. I think it would be an excellent time for us to harvest them.
We seek witch stones in battle, Caswallon asked, perking up, and set our swords against the foulest of sorcerers. My blade and my orb are eager for such chances at glory, he proclaimed.
I'd rather we have them than they, I agreed. The more of those we capture, the more we deprive Shakathet of their use.
Deliberately striking at an enemy to gain their property is not going to please the Enshadowed, Tamanil commented. It would not occur to them to seek the orbs, only to pursue victory.
We are pursuing victory, Landric shrugged. Ultimate victory, not just victory on this field. Taking more stones would help raise more High Magi. More High Magi mean a better chance at victory. Sometimes the primary goal in battle is not to win, but to force the enemy to lose.
That's a confusing way to look at it, Tamanil said after a moment's consideration. Shakathet would be livid at the temerity of such a strategy.
We're a confusing people, I agreed. The fact that assassinating his best enshadowed sorcerers and Gavanni shamans and taking their stones will piss him off only aids my cause. We need him weakened and angry when he meets us in the next battle.
It appears he will be short one giant, Astaroth said as he continued to observe the chaos below.
Lord Tiny seems to have found a pressing engagement elsewhere and has left the field. Yes, if the infantry depart now, it will take Shakathet hours to get organized enough to form a pursuit, he determined, especially if we deprive them of their sorcerers. All right, men, let's go sneak down there and cause some more panic. I think it's the season for it.
I don't know how far or how fast that giant ran that night, but there were reports of him still moving west for weeks. Whatever control Shakathet thought he'd had over the creature was gone after his bout of ornithophobia. As secret weapons went, this one was a failure. He had done significant damage to that portion of Shakathet's army on his way out. I was thankful about that. The chaos caused by the giant's reckless dance through the horde provided perfect cover for another sneaky assault. While the first of our infantry troops were quietly marching down the back of the hill, my team, and a score of other magi, took the battle to the foe for the first time. Sneaking around and slitting throats, along with the occasional magical duel, was a lovely distraction from what our troops were doing in the background. We didn't throw around a lot of active spells either. We didn't want to stir up an organized response if we didn't have to. We gave them Duin's own special stock of hell that night. Of course, Shakathet pulled many of his magical core back to protect the wane he was using as a headquarters, which left the others without either a plan or reinforcements. Those were perfect conditions. Caswallon alone slew scores of Gavanni while he chased a shaman through the camp, screaming impressive oaths at him the entire way. Tamanil and Barroso attacked one of the Enshadowed and relieved him of his stone by the simple expedient of cracking him over the head with an axe handle. We took four more enshadowed Irionite spheres that night and two Gavanni shamans' shards. Meanwhile, thousands of our men were marching away. Volleys of arrows got less frequent. By the time we returned to camp, much of camp had already packed up and begun the journey to the river. Dara and Natia brought both wings back to Megalyn with only a few injured. A rider and his bird had been struck by the giant's hand during the battle, but both were expected to recover quickly. Our entire army was talking about the brave Skyriders and how they drew the giant away, which was better for morale than Caswallon's soliloquy on the subject. In all, the Battle of Stannis Howe was a victory, though we did little to stop the onslaught of Shakathet's hordes. But that wasn't the point. We had successfully lured Shakathet into deploying and wasting a strong asset, and we had successfully allured a good portion of his forces away from the castles where they had been laying siege. In fact, though those reinforcements were still arriving at Shakathet's chaotic camp, they would have to set out almost immediately to have any chance of catching us. The three-day rain had swollen the region's rivers to flooding capacity. There would be mud for a week, and with that much rain, the nearest ford they could use to cross was north, in Yelin, just below the escarpment. Meanwhile, our troops would scoot across Shakathet's magical bridge and gain days on them as we headed for the next battlefield. I was starting to think Telemann's strategy was working after all.
Chapter 28. The Goddess and the Merchant. Outrage fades. Avarice is eternal. Magelore Folksane, from the collections of Janik the Riche. The retreat from Stannis Howe was about the most orderly retreat I'd seen. I credit the incredible efficiency of the Hessian order that controlled the towers.
tasked with logistics and supply, in addition to the defensive works they built, the war magi and attendants of the towers ensured that there was adequate water, food, and medical attention for the infantry that streamed down the eastern side of Stannis Howe that night. Troops departed by unit in an orderly fashion, shepherded by representatives of the Hessian Order, who kept track of everything. I wasn't sure who was overseeing the complicated logistics for Mistress Marsden, but they deserved ennoblement for how well and how quickly it was handled. When my team and the other war magi, hunting fresh witch stones in the chaos of the Gavanni camp, returned to the top of the Howe, there were less than 1,000 troops still present. These comprised the rearguard Marsden had selected to cover our escape. My fellows and I had done our best to sow as much disorder in Shacketh's camp as possible, to buy as much time as we could, and by that mark, we were successful. The giants danced through the Gavanni lines had killed scores and wounded hundreds. Mounting any kind of offensive was out of the question until order was restored. The 1,000 men who lingered provided a tempting target, I'm sure, but when your organization is smashed, and there's a foot of mud to slog through before you might reach them, it's going to be difficult to rally your troops, no matter what kind of undead lord is screaming at you. Come dawn, my men and I were sleepily packing up our camp and preparing to follow the last of the infantry down the eastern slope. We were exhausted, and I was tempted to pop back to Spell Garden for a nap, but I didn't think that would set a good example. The retreat from the Howe to the river was an essential part of Turlamund's plan. Being seen with the troops would do a lot more for morale than taking a nap. It only took an hour to make our way to the banks of the river. The wild water was swollen with the runoff of 3 days of rain, and the swirling waters looked dark and dangerous. The banks were far too steep, and the river too deep at that point to consider crossing, had not Shacketh provided us with the incredible bridge that spanned the river. Strong and sturdily built, the timber construction was designed to allow siege worms to cross. Bearing our troops, wains, and horses was no problem. Mavone and his company of ravens had placed it perfectly, so that the stream of marching infantry could go from one hellish battlefield to a relatively protected position in a few hours. "Compliments of his dark and terrible lordship, Shacketh," Mavone called out from the other side of the bridge as he watched me and my men cross the span with the last units of infantry. "The way they have this bridge configured, they could have crossed the wild water at nearly any point. Now they'll have to find a ford, which won't be easy. Not with the waters this high," he pointed out. "Luckily for him, most of Shacketh's artillery and baggage is bogged down in the muddy roads, or lies ruined around our castles," Landrick pointed out as we dismounted on the eastern bank. Mavone had set up a table and canopy to make his waiting more pleasant, while the rest of the troops were crossing the bridge. "He doesn't have a lot of heavy equipment left to lug around." "He can still cross at the fords of Yellen," Mavone frowned. "Even with the added rain, the river widens there so that it's only a few inches deep most of the time." "That ford is miles and miles up the river, however, and his troops are scattered all across the land now," Astaral said, pleased. "It will take him a few days to regroup before he can even attempt that. Conversely, he could regroup and then reinforce the siege at Megalyn, ignoring us entirely." "Then we would attack him from the rear with this army," I pointed out. "I don't like being ignored." "That's probably Turlamund's plan," Mavone agreed, producing goblets and wine for us all. The rain was still pouring, though not as fiercely as it had been. I could see that some enterprising wizard had taken the time to cast spells to keep the roadway, well, it was a roadway now, relatively dry and clear of mud. But those spells only work so well. "Well, we struck them a hard blow by driving their giant away," Barroso considered, as he gratefully took a goblet and poured wine. "In all my life, I never thought I would see such a thing. Legends walk the land," he said, shaking his head in amazement. "Just be thankful that they didn't use that poor beast at Megalyn," Astaral pointed out as he took a gentlemanly sip of his wine. "That thing could have torn apart the walls far easier than the siege worms, I would wager, although I regret that Azar did not have the opportunity to fight it. He'll be so disappointed." "Azar has plenty to occupy him," Mavone reported. "Indeed, when the bulk of the troops withdrew from the siege, he led a sortie of cavalry and war magi in a surprise raid against the besiegers.
It was highly effective, though not decisive. It did, however, free a postern door that they had been guarding. Azar has kept it clear, and now the Megalini knights are able to move much more freely. So the siege is not broken, just cracked, Barroso nodded. Cracked enough that the enemy commander must wonder whether it is productive to continue it, I agreed, especially when we have a large army in the vicinity that could attack him from the rear, and plenty of fight left within Megalin Castle. Much will depend on how Shakathet responds to the loss at Stannis Howe. Was it truly a loss? Landric asked. Apart from the giant, it was a glorified skirmish. Our casualties were light, and we escaped without inflicting much injury on the foe. Yet we did little to change the course of the war. From his perspective, it may seem that he drove us from the field. From our perspective, we lured his troops away from where they were being most effective to where they were nearly useless, Astaral countered. While we assemble an even greater army on the eastern bank, he must gather his forces and cross the wild water to meet us. The moment he does so, our garrisons will be able to attack them from the rear while he turns to face the army. I'll be happy to consider Stannis Howe a loss if the final result is a win for the war. That appears to be Turlamund's thinking as well, Mavone agreed. Fair will be the day when our wily commander's strategies lead to this foul Nemavort eating the bitter bread of defeat, spread with the relish of humiliation, Caswallon affirmed, adding nothing to the conversation. Where to from here, my lords? Tamanial asked politely. Eastward, I know, but to where? Mage Lord Turlamund has a talent for selecting battlefields that suit his purpose. I'm eager to know what stage he has chosen to enact this next act. Well, Turlamund has not given me the boon of that information, Mavone said thoughtfully. I have spoken with Mistress Marsden about this. Once the bridge is banished and we are safe behind the river's current, we are to encamp and take the rest of the day to rest and replenish ourselves. On the morrow, we march north, he revealed, likely to the pass up the escarpment east of the Falls of Yellen. If we press hard, we can reach it before they do. I wish Telamon would be more candid about his plans, Landric said, shaking his head. It is likely he is laconic in that regard because they are still evolving, I pointed out. This game has many pieces across a wide board, and Shakathet has proven a crafty opponent. Every move requires a countermove, and there is only so much planning you can apply to it. The spellmonger speaks wisdom, Caswallon pronounced. The fickle winds of circumstance oft alter our plans and require of us to swiftly react with wit and valour. Either that or Turlamund just doesn't want to commit to a plan, Astaral suggested. I might have tried to lure Shakathet back into the hills, but then I'm no grand strategist. But if we can place a force at the fords and contest his crossing, well, the Nemavorti don't have a good history of crossing rivers, he reminded us. Regardless, Marsden made clear that the speed of the march is essential, Mavone informed us. The closest unit Shakathet has is a day away, should they realize the necessity of capturing the ford. It is one legion, but it would make contesting the ford easier if there wasn't anyone there defending it. So, we have a lot of marching ahead of us, sighed Barroso. That is my third least favorite part of warfare. I didn't ask what the other two were, but it was fun to speculate. Actually, my friends, the infantry has a lot of marching to do, the poor bastards, Astaral observed. We are High Magi. We are mage lords. We can get sleep in real beds and eat hot food and restore and prepare ourselves for the coming hardships. Marching is so banal, he said, shaking his head in disgust. That seems unfair, to take rest when the infantry marches, Landric said. You are free to join them in support of their plight, my lord, Astaral proposed. As for me, a bath and day's rest in Vanador would put me in a far better mind than trudging miserably through the rain. The privileges of rank and station exist for a reason, gentlemen. As much as I'd love to march through the mud and rain again toward an uncertain future and a possibly violent end, I reluctantly agree with Baron Astaral. With the defeat of the giant, it will be days before another engagement with the foe requires our attention. I give you leave to adjourn, gentlemen, with the request that you be willing and able to rejoin the fight at a moment's notice, I said, feeling a little less guilty about slipping away now, because we were all thinking the same thing. Aye, Caswallon said enthusiastically.
Let us rest, repose, rearm, and then return to the fertile fields of victory. Perhaps when they aren't quite so muddy, he conceded. I bid you, gentlemen, to enjoy your respite, Mavone said cheerfully. I'll be remaining in the field to coordinate intelligence. I will not hesitate to rouse you from your soft, warm feather beds at the first hint of trouble. Ah, I believe that is the last of them, he said, noting the tired dregs of the rear guard crossing the bridge, taking the East Guard Tower standard with them. As soon as they cross, I can pack up, put the bridge in my pocket, and be on my way. I did desire sleep and food and the comforts of home, but not at the expense of my duty. Instead of Spell Garden, I used the ways to return to Megalyn. Despite the conjecture, I needed to know what Turlamon had planned. At least an outline, or an inkling. I used the main hall stone to come through and was quietly appalled at the number of wounded being treated there. It was more than doubled than the last time I arrived, and the pile of bodies and amputated limbs at the far end was daunting. But that is war, and in war, men die. On the way to the headquarters chamber, I paused to survey the ongoing battle in the outer bailey. From the battlements above, the situation appeared to be dire. The breach in the wall had allowed hundreds of Gavani and Maragorku to advance within bowshot of the inner bailey wall, but they had yet to progress beyond that. Three dead siege worms and a scattering of smaller corpses proved how fierce the fighting had been. The bailey yard was churned from the fight, and pools and puddles were starting to build in the mire. The Gavani were not attacking in a sortie, but they were still active. Crossbows rang out from behind heavy blinds as the goblins tried to sweep the sentries from the walls, but the archers in our towers were answering them shot for shot. All in all, it was a depressing picture, but it was misleading. While there were nearly 1,000 Gavani in the bailey, they had yet to erect any siege engines to make a serious attempt to gain the walls. At best, they had dragged 2 small mangonels into the yard and were making half-hearted attempts at finding the range of the wall. Not that it would do much. Azar and his war magi had been continuously strengthening Megalyn's keep and inner bailey for years now. Even aiming a shot at the wall was proving difficult for the Gavani engineers. Turlamon had let them in, I realized. He'd allowed them to force their way through the weaker bailey wall and all but begged them to try their mettle on the thick walls of the keep. They had not bothered to open other areas within the castle. They were still using the ragged breach in the wall to bring in supplies by porter over the rubble. The gatehouse was still in our hands, I saw, and was holding out valiantly against a few hundred Gavani who were trying to bring it down. They did not look like they were being very successful. I felt better as I mounted the stairs to the headquarters chamber. Despite the dire word from Megalyn, I saw that the castle was still intact, still fighting, and not particularly ruined at this point. That brought me some hope. Turlamon wasn't in residence, as he was checking on the preparations we were making on the east bank, and Bendanol was organizing another sally from the postern gate, but a few moments spent reading dispatches and staring at the map gave me a much better picture of where things stood in the war. According to the reports, most of Shakathet's forces that weren't engaged in siege work were spread out in a rough crescent that stretched from the fields of Western Yelin to just north of Salka, almost 100 miles of territory. Our troops, on the other hand, were in 3 main large groups. The reserves, gathered near East Guard Tower, the cavalry and field soldiers patrolling north of Megalyn, and the 4,000 reserves who would be marching up the east bank of the Wildwater toward Yelin. Yes, I could see, whoever controlled that ford would control the battle. I played out a variety of possible scenarios in my head and even used insight to give me some perspective on things. Shakathet would have to unite his troops if he wanted to cross the river and challenge our army. Sending them piecemeal would invite attack. Without his giant, and with a diminished magical core, his troop strength was not as much of an advantage as I'm sure he thought it would be. The news from the Wildalore was less sanguine. Preshar Castle was under heavy siege, now that the lake that guarded it had been drained. Markadine was holding out well for now, but the valiant Wildalords were being outmatched by sorcery as much as numbers. Still, he endured, and that was a hopeful sign. Satisfied for the moment on the state of the war, I spent a few hours visiting with the Skyriders to praise them for their excellent work, particularly against the giant. That made both Dara and Natia happy, especially when I threw a couple of purses of silver at them to drink to my health. The Muse Towers had done exemplary work throughout the war, and I knew their services would be vital in the coming days, perhaps even pivotal. Keeping the morale up was essential. It was noon before I took the ways back home to Spellgarden. Home. It occurred to me that I had started thinking of that beautiful little estate as home more than I did Sevendor. That bothered me, of course. I was in exile from my home. Yet, as I came through the ways into my workshop and took a moment to survey the estate from the top of my tower, I realized that I had built a home here as much as I had in Sevendor. It was smaller, of course, and still largely under construction, but my country estate was also a place of refuge and safety for my family. I felt secure here, overlooking the plateau to the east and the fertile vales to the west. The horizon might contain horrors, but they were far away, at least for the moment. I still loved Sevendor, I knew. I loved Sevendor the way you love your childhood pet, your first crush, the first truly complicated spell you master. Sevendor was grand and magical and merry, a city of magic that I had built, with some help, but I'm responsible for it. Most of it. But Spellgarden and all of Vanador was my masterpiece in the wizard's art, I knew. There were no nearby lords vying for my favor or my lands. There were no petty politics. Well, at least nothing I couldn't handle with a decent enough staff. Spellgarden boasted a relaxed nature compared to the busy, bustling streets of Sevendor. It was smaller, less crowded, more secluded, and it captured the best of why I came to the Wilderlands in the first place. Yes, Sevendor was my first real home, but Spellgarden was somehow more homey than my home. I was about to turn away when the actual garden of Spellgarden caught my eye. While the rest of us had been off fighting the war, the green steward of the estate, Salgren, had employed a small crew of Tal Alon to continue to build and plant the extensive garden complex that had always been part of my plan for Spellgarden. Well, after the goddess of herbs, Falassa, had told me to make it happen. The result, even in the rain, was already spectacular. Salgren made use of the many, many rocks removed from the soil and had constructed an elaborate complex of terraced planters across the gardens. A huge mound of rich, black soil, likely from the wizard mercantile, was heaped near the center, and smaller piles of gravel, manure, and sand sprawled at its base. Scores of earthenware pots bore an astonishing variety of seedlings, and many of the planters were already bursting into bloom. Trellises and arbors were being constructed, and a seemingly endless line of Tal Alon and human gardeners pushed wheelbarrows or dug into the soil with spades. The rain had slowed to a drizzle, and they bustled to take advantage of the break like they were ants on a hill. From above, the mud and dirt and plant life took on a much more coherent picture. The gardens below were like a verdant tapestry of botanical life, woven in rocks and soil. It was beautiful, and it reinforced the idea that Spellgarden was home now. There was no sign of the war here, no politics, no impending doom, no cries of the wounded or sobs of the bereaved, just the rustle of leaves and the smell of the soil. I inhaled deeply, closing my eyes not for any magical purpose, but to enjoy the purity of the garden. I began to fantasize about a life where a garden was the extent of my responsibilities. Yes, I needed to catch up on my sleep, I realized when I opened my eyes with a start. That's when I noticed the corral, usually filled with the cattle I'd spent so much coin on, was strangely empty. Nor did the nearby byre contain a single cow. I was about to take note of that when a goddess distracted me. "So, are you pleased, Spellmonger?" came an old woman's voice. It didn't take me long to figure out who it was, whom I had inadvertently invoked. Falassa, goddess of herbs and wisdom. "Quite," I admitted approvingly. "It's beautiful. It's vast. It's a start," the goddess grunted as she joined me at the battlement. "When this place is done, it will take over 600 varieties of plants and fungi." "More," she insisted. "You will grow herbs here that no one else in the Five Duchies can claim. Oh, it's all very conventional at the moment, but there will come a time when it is legendary."
Well, the arcane physicians and herbalists are certainly happy with what we've planted, I conceded. In a year, I think they'll be even happier. Of course, that's not going to help much with the current situation, but, well, they're pretty, I smiled.
Pretty? Falaza asked, offended. Young man, it doesn't matter if they are pretty. It matters that they are useful, and these most certainly are. You'll bring more, won't you? From your expedition to Angersbell this summer? She asked eagerly. There are herbs there that grow nowhere else on Kalador, she assured me with a wave of her hand. An expedition seems unlikely if this war does not conclude quickly, I sighed. Nothing would please me better, save Korbal falling into the nearest convenient abyss.
Ha! She spat. Wars? There are always wars. This war, the last war, the next war. But the herbs are eternal, or at least seasonal. This war will be over before you think, she promised. Your enemies are beset by problems you aren't even aware of. Disputes in command, lack of supply, miscommunications, outright mutiny in places. That foul, undead lord who drives the goblins is plagued by them, and only his domineering nature has kept his army in order. He has promised much to his dark master, and much is expected of him in return. Yet he disappoints Korbal.
I think we're all a little disappointed in him, I agreed. He's supposed to be one of the best generals that the Nemovorti can field, and he's been woefully conventional about most of his fighting.
I'm not complaining, I added. But apart from including a giant in his heavy infantry and being clever with his troop movements, he just hasn't lived up to his reputation.
Yet here he is, kicking your ass across the Central Vales,
Falaza snickered. I would have thought you would have taken decisive action about that by now.
I'm working on it, I said defensively. I have my best people on it, I amended.
What have you done then to help win this war? I asked.
Besides providing life-saving herbs to keep your wounded soldiers alive? She asked with a snort.
Why, not much. I'm a goddess of herbs and wisdom.
Wisdom dictates you don't go to war with a basket of herbs, she chided.
What good is the favor of the divine if it doesn't help you out when you need it? I complained.
What makes you think you aren't receiving help, spellmonger?
The crone goddess asked mockingly.
I do my part in my way, and your enemy is discomfited thereby. Are you familiar with poison ivy? Anathia blossoms?
The enshadowed aren't, she said with a wicked chuckle. They will be. There are just some private parts you don't want anywhere near poison ivy.
So we win the war with an itchy rash? I snorted.
I said the divine was involved, she argued. I didn't say it was all-powerful, nor am I the only one assisting you.
But this is not a war that the gods can fight, Falaza pronounced. Men must do that. Flawed, imperfect, impractical men.
Well, you got that part right at least, I sighed. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to criticize. I've had a rough couple of days. The war is experiencing some challenges, I said diplomatically.
And the war is not the only thing occurring right now, she countered, but it has stirred up some deep and ancient things that might prove far more challenging than what is currently in your flower pot, she warned.
I saw a giant, I informed her. Is that one of them?
No, not even close. That giant was a passing fancy compared to what is stirring, she warned. Poor thing. You know he's hiding now. Hiding in a hidden valley, deep in the forests. He's afraid to come out because of your birds, she reproved.
But I saw a giant and chased him off, I protested.
Isn't that a good thing? Not for the giant. They are gentle souls, save when they're roused. At least you didn't kill it. The forces I speak of are deeply hidden. They have been guarded for millennia, and for millennia they have plotted. They scheme to free themselves any way they can, she said darkly. They will use whatever allies they need to see that quest complete.
But until the war is over, I won't have the time or energy to address them. I take your point, but one crisis at a time, I pleaded.
You should be so lucky, she taunted. Spellmonger,
I did not come here to inspire doubt or grief, but to inspire hope and wisdom,
Falasa insisted. You might want to reassess your approach, I said dryly.
If you wanted someone to stuff daisies up your ass, perhaps you could talk to Ishi, she snapped.
I hear she's into that sort of thing. I'm here with common practical wisdom and hope and a kick to your pants to keep you motivated, if need be.
I'm plenty motivated, I insisted.
How could I not be? But how can I focus on the war when the entire world dies in 3,000 years? I demanded. Falasa did not appear to be impressed.
You take a tonic, quit complaining, and get to work, she recommended.
Really? You hired an arcanist to help you do so. Why aren't you using him? Instead, you fuss around with them Avorti and the poor Gavanni, and the real work has yet to be done. Win this war, quickly, and be prepared for the next. Win this war, quickly, and move on to the life you are building here.
I will, I promised the crotchety old goddess, using the same tone I used to appease my mother.
I defeated a giant today. Don't I deserve a rest?
You didn't defeat it. The giant Hawks did,
Falasa countered.
You just watched. But take the rest. You do need it, she considered thoughtfully. But not too long. There are many things to do in the world, and you must go and do them. There are weeds to be plucked and seeds to be planted. There are councils to call, decisions to be made, and greater questions to be answered, she finished cryptically. Do not tarry in the comfort of exile, spellmonger. The world awaits for you to come into your true power. There are bigger weeds than this Shakathet in the world that require your attention.
Then she faded away, and it smelled like chamomile and rosemary for a moment. I sighed heavily. I didn't swear. I was starting to understand that, for the spellmonger at least, casually invoking divinities was an invitation, not invective. But it was frustrating. As pep talks go, Falasa's had only reminded me of my shortcomings. I was no closer to answering the questions and solving the problems that mattered. I realized that I was using the war as a distraction from more important issues. Certainly it was a matter of mortal peril and the survival of my new realm, and it needed to be tended to. But it was also a tedious exercise compared to seeking answers to the questions I had and solutions to the problems that stood in my way. I was getting set for a really good brood when Planus reached out to meet mind to mind.
Menelan, you'll be pleased to know that Count Anvarum departed Verone this morning with the first elements of his army, he reported. After a lengthy audience with the Lord Steward, he was granted permission to invade the Mage Law, and the payment of a hefty fee for the privilege, 1,000 ounces of gold.
I smirked, despite myself. Apparently the Lord Steward didn't mind taking a cut from Prince Tavard's gold.
That is good news, I replied. And their route? Did you manage to learn that?
Learn it? I practically gave it to them, he said with a mental chuckle. And they paid for the privilege. Oh, not me personally, but one of the contacts I've cultivated in the army was told that an agent of mine knew exactly where the spellmonger was encamped and would part with that information for a generous fee. After coin changed hands, Count Anvarum learned that you and a small detachment of guards was putting down an outbreak of Gavanni activity somewhere near Mostel Abbey, where it is rumoured that Lady Matherian is being held. I added that last portion myself, he said, pleased. The Gilmorans are fixated on her captivity.
That's good, I praised. You've done well, Planners.
So, they are headed north. They are planning to sneak up on you from the south by avoiding the roads and your castles and going overland on the east bank of the river. Then they can confront you on the field with overwhelming force and demand the return of the maid and possibly capture or kill you. The knights have boasted of all the ransoms they will get once they prove the valour of the Gilmoran chivalry. They all know you're stinking rich.
Avarice is just as effective a motivator as outrage, I observed.
Oh, greed is far more effective, Planus said,
with the assurance of much personal experience. As angry as the knights of Gilmora pretend to be, it is the high pay and the chance at rich ransoms that compels them. Outrage fades. Avarice is eternal. It's a universal truth.
Planus's words rang in my head the rest of the day, as I spent it with Alia and the children and tried to get some rest. But so did Falassa's. It was a good day, mostly, and I did my best to relax and enjoy it. It was still too wet for the children to go out and play, so we stayed inside Spellmonger's Hall for my unexpected return from the war. As I indulged in swordplay with wooden swords with Menalion, or let Almina put ribbons in my beard, the words of the goddess and the insights of the merchant contended for the attention of my subconscious. Alia realized I was preoccupied and assumed it was the war. She said as much, and she wasn't wrong, but I wasn't worried about losing the war. I was worried that the damn war was getting in my way. And the idea that some gaudy jouster from Gilmora was planning on capturing me for profit made me angry in the abstract. I'd had rewards on my head from various parties for years, and after the novelty wore off, I mostly ignored them. Anyone who came against me was taking their life in their hands, and they should know it. Whatever price they would theoretically earn was meaningless, save to inflate my own ego. That night, over dinner, I told the children and Alia about the giant, Lord Tiny, and how the brave Skyriders had driven him off. They were variously captivated, amused, terrified, and enthralled in the tale, and I reminded myself to tell it to Janik. Perhaps he could make a witty song out of it. "I can't wait until I'm old enough to go on errantry and slay giants and dragons," Menalion said, confidently. "Daddy didn't slay the giant," Almina scolded him. "It was forced to attack. It wasn't his fault." "Yes, it was," scoffed my son. "He's a giant. They're evil."
"They are not," I informed him. "No more than any man or beast. Not even the Gavani are evil at their heart. They are just misled and badly informed."
"That doesn't stop you from slaying them," Menalion boasted. "You've killed like a million goblins."
"Not quite," I said, a little disturbed by the lad's bloodlust. "Indeed, I've spared quite a few. Someday, perhaps, we can convince them to lay down their arms and live in peace." Menalion snorted derisively.
"Goblins are goblins," he said, shaking his head. "But giants aren't, and I'm sure Lord Tiny is really very nice,"
Almina assured us, nodding vigorously with the authority of a child.
"He was just mistreated."
"Mistreated or not, if your father felt justified in slaying him, he would not hesitate," Alia told them. "But he does not seek to kill anyone if he does not have to. He tries to find something clever to do to avoid it if he can. That's what good wizards do," she said, catching my eye with approval. "Yes," I agreed, "that's what good wizards do." It was a restless night, and I tossed and turned in the comfort of my lavish bed. I dreamt of giants and herbs and evil undead and haughty and shadowed sorcerers. In the morning I awoke and felt like I'd not slept at all. But there was some vague thing lurking in the corner of my sleepy mind, the kernel of an idea. And I knew before my morning ale that I needed to go see Talaman. I knew how to end this war quickly.
Chapter 29. The Third Muse. It is better to arrive on time than to be invited. Wilderland's Folk Saying. From the collections of Janik the Rish. "It won't be long now," murmured Landric as we peered down at the road below. From the hidden perch on the steep hill, we could see nearly a half mile of road in either direction. "They should be arriving any time," he said, as he finished casting the spell. We were working on the eastern bank of the river, in a blind overlooking the pass up to the escarpment. It was one of many that the ravens had prepared for this sort of observation. My men were ready, rested, and rearmed after 3 days of leave, and we resumed our mission, but this time with more purpose. The first of the scouts were fell hound riders, and they loped past our position without even glancing up. A unit of 30 canine cavalry streamed angrily down the road from the ford. Big, ugly brutes they were, and powerful. Their goblin riders had shaved their heads and arms, which gave them a ghastly look. They seemed determined in their mission as their canine steeds loped down the road in the twilight. We let them pass. We were after bigger game than ugly puppies, and we knew it would come soon enough. All of Shakathet's great army was on the move across the fords of Yelin. The fell hounds were just the advance party. The rain had finally stopped,
which was great news for our troops on the march. But the result of 5 days of pouring rain became immediately evident in the streams and rivers of the Maegelor. They hadn't been so dangerous since the spring thaw. In some places, they swelled until their torrents were powerful enough to move boulders. In other places, the accumulated water burst out of the banks and flooded nearby fields and woods. It wasn't as dramatic as the spring thaw flooding, but it was more widespread. I'd hoped that the weather and the flooding would slow Shakathet's ability to move his troops around. But, alas, his brutal command compelled his Gavani army to reconstitute itself rapidly, as our foes coalesced into something that couldn't be ignored. With the reserves marching from the south with Mistress Marsden, the army that Sandoval commanded east of Yellen was nearly 10,000 strong. Unfortunately, Shakathet had no difficulty marching that number quickly, with just the two wandering divisions he'd had screening Megalyn from Vanador. As more of his troops arrived from the disaster at Stannis Howe and the sieges of Iron Hill and Fort Destiny, his army began to pool the same way as the floodwaters. Sandy had chosen an abandoned estate a few miles north of the escarpment as his camp. It was an excellent defensive position. The main goblin force would have to cross the swollen fords and attempt to climb the pass to even get to his camp, which would expose them to attack along the way. It would have been a wise strategy, some said, to maintain that position in the hopes of luring Shakathet into a protracted defensive battle that would favour us. But I disagreed. Thankfully, so did Telamon. He favoured a more direct strategy, and I wanted a quick end to the war that didn't involve our defeat. We consulted for hours in Megalyn and considered many different possibilities before we enacted the plan. But much depended upon what Shakathet chose to do.